Well, somebody reminded me in one of the groups that the theme for the day is the one who's not busy. We haven't really talked about it at all, and I figure that many of you, anyway, were at the talk last night. Is that right? Not everybody, but many. And so I talked a lot about the one who's not busy last night, and so I want to kind of review and go a little further with some of the things I said then. So probably we're all busy people, I'm guessing. That's the condition of our time. We're all busy. We can be busy, so we are. And there's a tremendous proliferation of tasks and jobs. There are things that we have to do now that we didn't even know we had to do, you know, 20 years ago. And that means not only things in the world, objective things in the physical world, but inner things. Who knew we had to meditate, you know, 50 years ago? And now look at all this work we have to do with our meditation. So we're very busy people. And, you know, I remember when I was young, some famous social thinker wrote a book about the future. People are always writing books about the future, and so far they've never been right, you know, but they keep writing books about the future. And the theme of the book was, you know, how are we going to handle it when we hardly have anything to do anymore? Because technology and the advance of society is going to make all these jobs that we have to do obsolete, and it'll be taken care of by machines or something like that. And this is going to be the great challenge. In the year 2000, people are going to have to figure out how to work 2 days a week or 3 days a week with a full salary and somehow fill the rest of that time in ways that are satisfying. And this is going to be the real challenge for the year 2000. But it didn't turn out that way. Even though, in fact, it's really true, you know, people in the past used to have to manufacture, I don't know what, their own candles and their own soap and, you know, their own food, and they used to have to build their own houses, and when they broke, fix them. And none of that do we have to do. So how come we're so busy? Well, what nobody figured on was the infinite proliferation of human desire. You know, the guy who wrote that book in 1970 wasn't thinking hard enough. He didn't realize that if we eliminate a certain number of human desires and human needs, that doesn't mean that there'll be less of them, because we'll have more. And in fact, desire seems to have that quality to it, that as desire gets going, it creates even more and more. There's an acceleration, you know, of desire. It's kind of pretty much goes along in exactly the same curve as the economy. Pretty much it's the same curve. Desire and the economy go in the same way. So we have so much to take care of, and so much that we want to take care of, and a lot of the stuff that we're taking care of is, you know, things like our human relationships. We now know that we can't take them for granted, that it takes some effort to relate to one another in the right way, in the way that we want to. So it's not as if the things that we're doing are all trivial, or our hearts, our souls, our bodies. You know, now we know that we have to exercise and so forth, you know. So there's lots to do, and we're very, very, very busy. And being busy, basically, when you think about it, it is a question of time, right? Because if the day were 48 hours long, we would say, "Hey, there's no pressure. You know, I got 24 more hours to work with. So yeah, there's a lot to do." But busyness means exactly that we think that there's more to do, then we have time to do it. And that's what it means to be too busy. So this means that we have to think about time. What is time? And why do we think there's not enough of it? And I was talking last night about, in essence, the difference between lived time, the time of our life, of our actual living, and clock time. And we think that time is clock time. We think time is a commodity like cotton or pork bellies. And you know, there's so much of it. And we buy time. We say that, I'm going to buy some time. I'm losing time. Things like that, these expressions, tell you that we think of time as a limited commodity. And when there's not enough of it, we feel too busy and pressured. But lived time is not a commodity. Clock time is a convenience. And actually, the organization of our lives around time, clock time, is a very conscious effort to rationalize our lives for the purpose of production. I remember some years ago, my wife, I have a long relationship to a sangha in Mexico that I've practiced with for many years, and I started going down there because my wife went to visit there one time, and I remember when she came home, she was so astonished, mostly by the relationship that people had to time in Mexico at that time. This is about maybe 20 years ago. She said, you know, we were rowing across this sort of lake that was kind of like shallow and swampy, some kind of motorboat. Puttering, going somewhere, and the boat broke down, and we couldn't go any further, and nobody seemed to care. It wasn't a big deal. We just sort of stopped what we were doing, and we, you know, did whatever we had to do, and it didn't matter when we got there, and when we got there, we got there, and something else happened that wasn't supposed to happen, and nobody seemed to mind, and it was just fine. She said, if that happened here, you know, everybody would be freaking out, and we're supposed to be there, and, you know, all this. The whole sense of how people were living in time was completely different. Of course, it's not that way now, in that same place in Mexico, because in order to improve conditions in Mexico, people there also need to be more and more on clock time. But clock time is supposed to work for us, not the other way around. We find ourselves now at the mercy of the clock. Zen Master Dogen, who's one of the great founders of our tradition in Japan, a 13th century towering religious genius, he wrote an essay called, in Japanese, Uji, which means time being. Time being. And in Uji, he says, time is not a container in which we are. Time is being. There's no, wherever something is, there's time. Wherever there's time, there's something. There's no abstract thing waiting to be filled up called time, and then something goes in it. There's no way to be existing outside of time. To be existing, it means you're existing in time. And time is nothing more than existence. And that's a simple thought, but it's very profound. And it occurs to me that Martin Heidegger, the great German philosopher, who probably is the premier philosopher in the 20th century, wrote a book called Being and Time, in which he says exactly the same thing that Dogen said, although he clearly had never read Dogen, because Dogen wasn't translated into German or any Western language at the time that Heidegger wrote Being in Time, which was 1927. And Heidegger actually took on the entire edifice of Western metaphysical thought and said, in effect, I'm oversimplifying it, not that I understand Heidegger, but this, as far as I understand it, he was saying that the entire edifice of Western metaphysical thought fell down because it failed to realize that time is being, and being is time. So time is life, and life is time. There can't be life without death, which is why the Buddha taught impermanence. Impermanence is how it is, how life is. And time is the mystery of our living and dying. It's not a substance. It's not a container in which we put our lives. It is the essential nature of our lives. That we are here means we are impermanent. And that's true of everything that exists. Anything that exists. A stone doesn't die, but a stone is also impermanent. And in that sense, it dies. Anything that is by virtue of the fact that it is not. Not. But can be not. Right? And will be eventually not. So this is the essence of our living. This is the actual basic fact of our living. So time can't be a commodity. We can't lose time. And we can't gain time. Time can't be short, and it can't be long. Time is the mystery of being alive. When we go to our breath, go to the feeling of the body in the present moment, we're actually returning to the mystery of time, to the mystery of being, to the mystery of impermanence. And by its nature, we can't understand it as something outside of ourselves. We can only return to it, but we can't understand it as an object. So that's why time can't be an object. It can't be a commodity. It can't be a container. Sometimes, you know, one other thing that I share with Rodney that I think makes us very instantly friends is that we've both done a lot of work with the dying, and it's sort of been a basic work for us in our spiritual lives. And sometimes, like, I have a friend who's been ill for a while, and he called me the other day and he said, so now finally it happened. Now they're telling me I have 6 months to live, 4 to 6 months. And it's kind of funny because he's very excited about this. He loves this idea. Because he's been kind of in despair and depressed for a while and not knowing, like, what the hell am I alive for? You know, this is terrible. The conditions of my life are so bad. I don't want to live. I don't know what I'm doing here. Now that the doctor told him he's got 6 months to live, he's really happy, you know. So now he thinks there's a limit to this, and now I can get active and do something. And he's calling up all his friends and telling them, guess what? 6 months to live. Come over. We'll say goodbye. And, you know, it's true. I mean, I think of him a lot, and I all the time I'm chanting for him and praying for him. But it's hard to get out. He's far away. It's hard to go visit, you know. Now I'm visiting. Right? So very good idea. 6 months to live. Excellent. But 6 months to live is nothing. It's a fiction. You know, this is clock time. How much time does he have to live? Exactly the same amount of time that you and I have. Exactly the same amount of time that we all have. That's how long he has to live. I had another friend many years ago who got cancer and died when he was really young, maybe maybe I don't think he was 40 yet. And he was a poet, and a brilliant poet, and a thinker. And I remember conversations with him. You know, he knew he was dying, and there was limited time. I remember conversations with him when we would actually talk it through to the point where we would both become utterly amazed and confused by the fact that even though on one hand it was true that he had a limited lifespan and it wasn't going to last long, on the other hand there was an infinite amount of time. And we were so confused by this, you know. We got there in the conversation. We would end the conversation like looking at one another in a daze, you know. How could this be? But it's really true. We all are alive in just this immeasurable moment. How could we be too busy in this one immeasurable moment, which is the only place we're ever alive? So I had the idea of, you know, starting a business of selling the following meditation to large corporations, but I don't think I could get away with it there, but I think I could do it here. And here's the theory. It's a time management theory. I was going to go to corporations and say, I have the ultimate plan for time management. This will make all your executives most efficient. Meditate on death. And you'll save a lot of time. If you think you're too busy, you know, remember what your life really is. Remember that your life will end. And I think it will make you realize that you're not busy at all. So let's take a few moments to meditate on death. So be with your breath, be with your body. And I'm going to say a few things and then be silent. And the idea is that I'll say some things and then ask you to just be silent and reflect on them and let them sink in. And then I'll bring up the next point and let you sink in with that one and the next point. So the first point I would like you to meditate on, to deeply consider in your heart, is the reality that death is absolutely certain. The one thing, the only thing in your life that you can count on is the fact that death will come. A moment of time just like this one will one day appear in your life, and it will be the last moment. So this is the first reflection, the inevitable certainty of death. And the second reflection is this, that although death is certain. The time of death is uncertain. No one can say how much time there is left. No one can predict when death comes. 1 year, 2 years, 20 years, today. No one can know. We think people die in old age, but plenty of young people die. Middle-aged people die. Old people die. No one can know the time of death. And finally, when death comes, we will go, each one of us will go alone. No one can go with us. And at that time, our accomplishments, our diplomas, our bank accounts, the books we wrote, won't make any difference to us. The only thing that will help us at that time is the quality of our heart. How we have lived, how we have loved. That's the only thing that will help us through the passage of death. So the next time you think you're too busy because you didn't answer an email or pick up the clothes at the laundry or take your car in for repairs or finish the report that was due at work, try to remember what's really important. What's really important is the state of mind, the state of heart in which you live your life every day. And I think if you do, you won't feel busy. You'll stop. you'll take a breath, and you'll reset, you'll switch your mind. Now, I'm not saying you should stop everything you're doing and think about when you're going to die all day long. No, please go and take the clothing to the cleaners and go to the garage and pick up your car. But do it knowing what's really important, knowing why you're doing those things and why anybody would do those things. Don't get wrapped up in all the things you're doing. Stay connected to the purpose of your activity and to the reality of what you are and what your life is, and appreciate the preciousness and the infinity of every moment of time. Last night, I spoke about it, a Zen story, which is often called The One Who's Not Busy. And I'll bring up that story again today for those of you who didn't hear it last night. It's interesting to note that pretty much, I don't know what the percentage is, but 90%, I'll say, of Zen literature, Zen teachings, are conveyed through dialogue. I mean, that's interesting to think about that. It's unique in world literature, including in Buddhism, although actually, when you think about it, the early suttas are also conveyed in dialogue. Mostly, somebody's asking the Buddha questions and the Buddha's responding. So, in Zen, the dialogues are usually shorter and more punchy, you know. But it's the same idea that there is no doctrine that's pre-existing. There's only our interactions with one another, our warm-hearted relationships in which we're trying to share with each other what's important in life and how do I get through this, you know. And out of that comes the teaching, and the Buddha always spoke to conditions that were present at the time, and so did the Zen people. And they had very intimate relationships, you know. They were really getting down there with each other, you know, about what this is all about and what are we doing together. And that's really, in a way, I think the most important thing about the Zen dialogues is the intimacy of the connection between the people and the seriousness of it. You know, let's interact with one another in this life on the basis of what's really important to us. Let's not get bogged down in stupid controversies. Let's always bring it back to what's most important. And that's really what all the Zen dialogues are doing. And so this story that I'm about to tell you is one such dialogue. But what I like about this story is that's unusual about it is that many of the stories, the ones that we're familiar with, seem to involve a hierarchy of authority, in that the typical Zen story we think involves the teacher who knows everything and the student who needs to be straightened out. But in fact, that's not the case. That looks like that's what's going on. But more often than not, it's peers in the Dharma, bringing up the Dharma together. And that's the case in this story. This is two monks who actually were brothers. They were biological brothers and also practiced together in monasteries, and often traveled together from one monastery to the other. And a lot of the Zen stories involve these two guys because they were so close to one another. And one was the older brother and sort of like a little bit scolding, like your older brother or sister is a little bit always telling you what to do, you know. And the younger one who sometimes is actually humbly accepting, you know, instructions, and sometimes seems to be humbly accepting instructions and isn't, and sometimes turns the whole thing on its head and instructs the elder brother. So their names were Yunyan and Dawu, and Yunyan was the younger brother, and Dawu was the older brother, and Yunyan was sweeping the temple grounds, and Dawu looked at him and said, "Too busy." And Yunyan said, "You should know there's one who's not busy." And Dawu said, "Oh, you mean there are two moons?" And Yunyan held up his broom and said, "Which broom is this? Which moon is this? Which moon is this?" And that's the story. So I talked about this at some length last night, and I won't repeat all the things I said. I'm not even sure I remember what I said. But it has something to do with the resolution of the dilemma that we always find ourselves in, where we get caught in the idea of, you know, time is a container, it only holds so much, we have too many things to put in it, there's not enough space in there, so we're too busy. The alternative to that would be there are fewer things to do, less to put in the container, then we would not be busy, then we would be peaceful, and then we would be relaxed. But as long as there's this limited container of time and so many things to put in it, we're busy, and that's the opposite of being not busy. All these assumptions are false. They're products of the way we usually look at things. I mean, they certainly do us a lot of harm, and they rush us around, and, you know, so they're effective conceptions, and they have a lot of impact on our lives, but they just happen not to be true. And it's a choice to look at it that way. We could look at it otherwise. And we're trying to, in our practice, train our minds to look at it differently so that we understand that when we think we're too busy, we're enwrapped in a set of conceptions. It's not a fact that we're too busy. It's a fact that we feel too busy, that we think we're too busy. That's the fact. And when we know that, we can take a step back and untangle all this and switch our minds, you know, not be driven by that. So that's what he means when he holds up the broom and he says, which moon is this? This is beyond the two moons of, you know, the dichotomy of busy or not busy. This is beyond that. What I didn't say last night is an interesting reference. Where does this come from, the two moons? And it comes from one of my favorite sutras, the Shurangama Sutra. It's an image from that sutra, and it has to do with looking at the full moon. And it says in there that try this experiment. Look at the full moon, and then press your thumb on one of your eyeballs for a moment, and then look at the full moon again, and you'll see two moons. And they'll both look equally real. Your experience will be that there will be two moons there. Like today in the dining hall, you know, I was eating lunch and I looked out at the floor, and the floor was pure white. You know, and it actually was pure white. I mean, if you asked me, I wouldn't say it was pure white. I would say, well, it's just, you know. But actually it was pure white because the sun was shining and reflecting on it, and the floor was actually pure white. So, but I don't think that. My eye doesn't tell me that unless I'm really looking. So the way things are, and the way things appear, it's a little different ways, you know. And when we press the thumb on the eye and look at two moons, we're pretty convinced there's two moons there. And they both look real. But one of them is real and one of them isn't. So it's like that, you know. The world that we look at looks pretty real. But actually, it only looks that way because we've been pressing our thumb, you know, on our hearts. And it's created distortion, you know, in the way we see things. Now, the interesting thing about this metaphor is that the one moon is the moon. And the other moon, which looks exactly like the first moon, is an illusion. But the sutra goes on to say, even the first moon is an illusion. In other words, we can look at things as they, in their illusory aspect caused by our own confusion, or we can look at things in a more true aspect with less confusion, with unburdened hearts. The world looks different when your heart is unburdened. You're not busy when your heart is unburdened. But the sutra says, even the real moon is not the whole story, because behind the real moon is the mystery that we will never be able to see. And And I think that one of the most important things in our spiritual development is to step back into that mystery, to feel comfortable with it, not be frightened of it, to know that it's thanks to that mystery that we're here and that we can trust it. Everything's not up to us. Just like when we sit down, we don't have to make it happen that the earth holds us to our place. It just does that. And similarly, reality takes care of us. We don't need to make it happen. There's a commentary to this story of the one who's not busy. It goes like this. Good people, as you eat, boil tea, sew and sweep, you should recognize the one not busy. Then you will realize the union of mundane reality and enlightened reality. The union of mundane reality and enlightened reality. So it's not that we need to escape from mundane reality to enter enlightened reality. It's not that we need to get rid of the crazy spinning world so we can rush off to the retreat where everything is peaceful and Buddhistic. Just recognize the one who's not busy, and you will realize the union of mundane reality and enlightened reality. In the Dongshan line, which is the style of Zen that I practice, this is called simultaneous inclusion. Simultaneous inclusion. Last night I ended my talk with a stirring description. Some of you were there and heard this. I thought it was really inspiring, of cleaning my bathroom. The detail of how that was, you know. And I said that in cleaning my bathroom, I had the consciousness that I was cleaning up the whole world and making a beautiful offering to the Buddhas, to the highest beings that there are. You know, please accept this gleaming, gorgeous bathroom. And that's the practice of simultaneous inclusion. In each thing, everything is there. So we don't need to feel time pressure to get a whole bunch of things done. Just do one thing. All you need to ever do, and all you're ever going to do, is one thing. And if you can do that one thing with simultaneous inclusion, recognize that everything is there in that thing, and it's an offering, it's a gift, you're never busy. And recently, in my Dharma seminar at home, we were studying a very complicated and difficult sutra in the emptiness philosophy called the Ashtasahasrika Prajnaparamita Sutra, the Prajnaparamita Sutra in 8,000 lines, which is a very complicated philosophical sutra. So I said to people, now, there's homework assignment. The homework assignment is not to read the sutra. You could read it if you like, but the homework assignment is to wash the dishes every day. And when you wash the dishes, to recognize the real nature of time and of the dishes while you're doing it. To really engage in that activity in the spirit of simultaneous inclusion, in the recognition that when you wash each dish, you're washing the whole world and you're making an offering in peacefulness to the world. Can you wash the dishes in that spirit? If you can wash the dishes in that spirit, you don't need to read the sutra. Because that's the understanding of it. The empty, infinite, ineffable nature of washing the dishes and everything else. That's time management. That's how we overcome being busy. So you can practice like this. Imagine that something that you're going to do, something practical and everyday, is not something you're going to do just to get it done. I think, actually, housework is the best thing. And in Zen monasteries, you know, they specialize in housework. They do. They're really into cleaning. They have a mania for cleaning up everything. You know, in Japanese temples, which are made out of cedar wood, it's required. The cedar wood must be wiped, every piece of it must be wiped down every day. Otherwise the building goes to pot. It has to be wiped down because the wood dries out and it requires moisture to be applied every day. So the monks have to go out and wipe down everything, you know, every day. The floors, the banisters. And they do it with that spirit. They do it as a spiritual practice. So if you have any housework to do, and you think, oh God, I gotta get this done so I can get off and do the important stuff, the necessary stuff, switch your mind and give yourself to your activity in this spirit. And you'll find that it's really pleasant and enjoyable. Everything you do can be the practice of simultaneous inclusion, which is the unity of mundane, so-called mundane reality and enlightened reality. Can you figure out how to do this? Can you find out how you can bring your attention to the things you're doing in this way? Train your mind that way. When you find your mind glancing off and getting bored and thinking, oh, I have to rush off to the next thing, bring it back, just like when you're meditating. Why is it any different from meditating? Why don't you just bring your mind back the same way that you bring it back on your cushion? And the only reason why it's different is because we think so. Meditation, oh, that's spiritual. That'll definitely help me. Washing the dishes is a waste of time. It's got to be done. But why is that so? Actually, it's not. So train your mind this way with everything that you do. Talking to another person, why would you want to make that encounter just something to get through? Want to get the information, want to get them to do what I want them to do. Want to get through, you know, take care of this interaction so I can go on to the next thing. Why would you want to do that? Why don't you stop everything and enter infinite time? Simultaneous inclusion. And realize that there is nothing on this earth more important happening anywhere than this moment of encounter with another person. And you will see then the difference between the two moons. You'll be able to tell which moon is an illusory moon, a distorted moon, caused by the pressure you've been putting on your heart all this time without knowing it. And you'll lift your thumb from your heart, and that distorted moon will disappear, and you'll just see the moon of your true activity. And you'll sense, although you won't see it, the moon behind that moon, the moon that never can be seen and never will be seen. And when you find yourself saying, I'm so busy, I'm so under such pressure, you'll just listen to yourself saying that and you'll say, ah, there I go again. That is so not true. And you'll let it go. You'll know what you're doing. You'll stop allowing the habit of distorted thinking and seeing to run your life. You may not be able to make it go away altogether, but at least you'll know what it is. And when you know what it is, it won't impact you in the same way. So last night I made a number of suggestions, and I'm wanting not to repeat myself, you know, all that I said last night, but you remember, some of you. I suggested something as simple as taking 3 breaths anytime. When you forget, when you find yourself overcome with busyness, the feeling of busyness, because that's what we're talking about. Take 3 conscious breaths and let the world brighten up and switch your mind and let go and reset, restart, and go forward again. Last night I also suggested that we practice walking meditation all the time, not just when we go on retreats, but any time when we're walking from one place to another. We don't have to do it as slowly as we did it today. It can be done more quickly, but the point is to return awareness to the body and to have that as a practice, as a constant practice, whenever you walk. I was quoting to somebody in one of our interview groups, which have been fun, by the way. I've enjoyed the interview groups. Just now, I said, okay, last chance, who wants to speak? And somebody pause a minute, then somebody raised their hand. I said, okay, good. Now, we'll finish that. Okay, last chance. Somebody else. It's fun. Somebody in one of the groups asked me something, and I was quoting another favorite story, Zen story of mine, where a monk asked Zhaozhou, what is meditation? And Zhaozhou said, it's non-meditation. And the monk said, how can that be? How can meditation be non-meditation? And Zhaozhou said, it's alive. You see? Meditation is not really fundamentally different from anything else. Life is meditation. Every moment of life brings forth the possibility of the practice of simultaneous inclusion. And meditation is even bad for you if you think that meditation is like this peaceful thing over here, completely divorced from the rest of my life. I've got to rush off to meditation in order to have some peace of mind. No, the point of coming to retreat is not to find some peace fleeing from the difficult world. That's not the point. The point is to understand our lives and to train our hearts and minds so that every moment is a moment of encounter with what's real. That's the point. And it can actually be counterproductive. You know, what's the difference between rushing off to a meditation retreat to escape reality and taking a drug? You could cost it out. Drug might be cheaper. I mean, I guess maybe drugs are bad for you. But then, who knows? Nobody did much research on meditation. Maybe meditation's bad for you, too. I don't know. Probably not. Don't worry. But you get the point. That's what we're doing here. We're not here to escape into a peaceful Shangri-La of Buddhistic bliss. Oh, it's time to stop. So I appreciate the day very much. It goes by fast. It's a little scary, isn't it? Time goes by very fast. Yeah. So, let's use the time well and thoroughly. So, maybe we can return to silence for maybe 1 minute. And then, peacefully, everybody goes home. So let's just breathe together for a moment or two. Find right now the one who's not busy. Thanks very much. And I guess I'll see many of you, most of you, tomorrow. I hope you can have a peaceful evening.